Number 16. Track C. Forensic Issues and Hacker Prosecutions.
Thank you. Thank you. Can you guys hear me?
No.
What?
I get the bad room. Can you guys hear me now? If I talk into this thing? Okay. I'm Jennifer Granick. I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I work in San Francisco. I represent people who are charged with all sorts of crimes, but I represent people who are charged with computer crimes and hacking and that sort of thing. And I'm here to speak with you today about special forensic issues, legal and factual issues, that come up in the investigation and prosecution of computer crime cases. There's some issues which come up in all sorts of criminal investigations, which are particularly thorny in the field of computer crime investigation. One of those issues is identity. Who is the perpetrator? Now, when we want to know who did something like breaking into a house, you may have something like fingerprints. You may have a person who saw the perpetrator enter the house and is an eyewitness who can recognize the person from a lineup or something like that. But in the field of electronic crime or computer crime, we have a couple of things that make that identification of the person a little bit more difficult. And one of those things is anonymity and the way that the internet or computers can provide anonymity to the user. So an anonymous remailer, Usenet, or encryption are all examples of things that provide the user with anonymity. Once the person uses something like that, it becomes difficult for law enforcement to figure out who's the person who did the crime. Another problem with that investigators encounter in the prosecution or investigation of computer crime cases is authentication. Here we have evidence which is of a digital or electronic nature, and by its very nature, it is both more easy to destroy and less easy to destroy. What makes it more easy to destroy is that it's very delicate, and it can be erased or altered very easily. So when the investigator comes upon the evidence and when the defense attorney takes a look at the investigation, one of the primary questions that you're asking yourself is, does this piece of information come from where they say it does? Does it mean what they say it means? And if all that's true, does that mean that your client's guilty? So we have a problem with authenticating evidence and figuring out its provenance. Where does it come from? How did it get there? Which we don't necessarily have when you have a smoking gun lying on the floor of a building. And finally, and perhaps I think these days one of the thorniest of issues that comes up in an investigation and prosecution of these types of cases is the question of the value of property or the assessment of damage or loss. And I'm going to talk about this a little bit later on in connection specifically with Kevin Mitnick's case. But these are almost two different questions, but they're very similar. In the valuation of property, oftentimes what's happening in a pure hacking case is that somebody's looking at something they're not supposed to look at, or making a copy of something that they're not supposed to make a copy of. Or, for example, let's say a bunch of credit card numbers. And then the question is, what is the value of that property taken? How can you tell how much that's worth? And it matters because it matters when you're trying to assess how bad the crime is that the person did. And it matters when you're trying to figure out what kind of sentence the person's going to get and how long they're going to go to prison for. So two very important questions. In cases involving, for example, credit card numbers, what the Department of Justice likes to say is that the value of the credit card number is the potential loss, which is how much that person has in credit. So if I have a $5,000 credit line and somebody steals my credit card number, even if they never use it, the government will say that that is a $5,000 loss. That's the potential loss right there. And you can have, when you steal, for example, a credit card file from an ISP, is particularly if it's a large ISP, for example, like Netcom or something like that, you're talking about thousands and thousands of credit card numbers with possible credit limits of $1,000, $2,000, $5,000. It really adds up. And next thing you know, the guy's looking at some serious time in prison. Now, what we have to ask is that really a fair or true estimation of the seriousness of the crime and the value of what was taken? And then we also have to ask that same question when we're talking about pure trespassing or pure hacking crimes, where all someone's really done is go into a computer system that they weren't supposed to be in and look around. Now, the way that the Department of Justice, the way that the government will value the loss there is how much it costs for the victim to put their system back in the condition in which it was in before the intrusion occurred. So let's think about this for a second. I go and I get into some ISP. And I look around and see what they've gotten there, and then I leave. The ISP decides that for security purposes, they have to check out everything, make sure I didn't install any back doors, that I didn't download any credit card numbers, that I didn't set up any accounts for myself for which I'm not paying, things like that. And they get their star person on it, and the star person makes about $150 an hour, which is not an outlandish hourly wage in the field of computer security, is it? No. So, and they spend a lot of time looking through and making sure that everything's okay. They spend, let's say that it takes them a week to do their whole work. Now, they multiply the hourly rate by the number of hours that the person worked, and that's considered to be the damage. Even though the person who is the intruder, in this example, it's me, never actually took, erased, copied, or really damaged anything. So, these are issues which are somewhat particular or peculiar to the investigation and prosecution of computer crime cases. Now, when you are, this brings up some practical considerations that an investigator wants to make sure that they pay attention to. And one of them is that when they're doing the investigation, you want to make sure if you're the person who's the investigator, that you're looking for the right stuff and that you're looking in the right place. That is, the places that are going to give you the information that you need to find out who did it and what they did. Second thing that the investigator wants to concern themselves with is authentication. How are you going to show to the prosecutor and to the defense attorney later on down the road that the information that you've collected or seized is in the condition that you found it in, it has not been altered or changed or tainted in any way by the collection of it, and is in fact what you say it is and is where you say it's from? So authentication becomes a serious concern. And the third thing the investigator really needs to concern themselves with is that the seizure of the evidence is done properly. Now, search and seizure is my favorite thing, so I'm going to get a little more in-depth here, and I'm going to define a couple of terms just to make a few things clear. Okay, first of all, does anybody know what the difference is between a subpoena and a search warrant? Can anybody say the difference between that? I'll let you. Yes, you.
Search warrant is issued by a judge after probable cause by law enforcement to search a defined area, piece of equipment or whatever.
Right. So a search warrant is an order by the judge which is based on probable cause issued by a neutral and detached magistrate. These are your legal terms of art for those of you who are taking notes. And what that means is that in order to get it, the law enforcement has to show probable cause that it's more likely than not that they're going to find something that can assists in their investigation of the case. The magistrate has to be neutral or not biased when he issues it, and the warrant has to specifically describe the place to be searched and the things to be seized, what you're looking at. It's narrowly defined. Now, with a subpoena is often called a court order, but it's a different kind of court order. I write subpoenas at my desk in my office and send them out every day. And after I send them out, it says on them, return it to the court. I call the person I'm subpoenaing up and I say, just mail those records right to my office and you won't even have to bother to show up in court. That's what a subpoena is. Nobody looks at it. Nobody judges it. Nobody issues it really but me. Now,
does a subpoena have to be written by an officer of the court, such as yourself?
You know, I don't know, because I am an officer of the court, so I've never not been able to issue them. I'm not sure if an investigator who would be an agent of mine could issue it. I think that's a possibility that my investigator would be able to, but it's possible I would need to sign it.
I'm almost positive it's an officer of the court.
Because I think I might have to sign it. But since I am an officer of court, I've never encountered that problem. Good thing for me. So there's two issues that come up when you have a subpoena. Well, one issue really that comes up, and the question with the subpoena is the question of notice. And here we're talking about a subpoena, for example, to, let's say, Yahoo. And I have been defamed. I want to know by somebody whose name is Bozo at Yahoo.com. And I want to know who Bozo is because I want to sue that person. So I issue a subpoena to Yahoo saying I want to know the identity, the account information for Bozo. Now, Yahoo, particularly if I'm law enforcement, but even if I'm a private person who's been defamed, Yahoo may see a lot of personal interest or corporate interest in cooperating with me and giving me that which I need because they want to keep a good relationship with me, and really don't have much of an interest in keeping a good relationship with Bozo, who's got a free account and is obviously some criminal or defamer who they don't really necessarily need. So they feel like, okay, well, they'll turn the information over. Well, what are Bozo's rights in these circumstances? And the question there is whether or not Bozo is going to get notice that the subpoena has been served on this third party, in my example, Yahoo. If Bozo gets notice, if Bozo gets notice, then he has the opportunity, or she, since it's an anonymous person, has the opportunity to come to court and to try to quash the subpoena and say that that information should not be turned over to me or to law enforcement or to whomever the subpoenaing party is. If Bozo doesn't get any notice, then I get the information behind Bozo's back. He never knows anything. He's never the wiser. And next thing he knows, he gets slapped with a lawsuit for something that he thought he was saying in a relatively anonymous context.
Isn't that a pretty sly method if they have to show up in court to defend their name and to try to quash the subpoena? I mean, they lose their anonymity right there.
You hire a lawyer to do it for you and move to quash it as John Doe. So you can do it under a false name. You can appear in court with a lawyer under a false name, and then you don't have to appear personally. The question was, isn't that a sneaky way to get Bozo to come to court? And I said Bozo can send his lawyer instead.
So the lawyer can appear by or alone without anyone there?
Right. The lawyer doesn't need to be accompanied by the client, particularly in civil cases. Although, just FYI, in a felony case in California, you're obligated to appear even if you have an attorney. What's the basis to determine what can and cannot be subpoenaed? Anything can be subpoenaed, and if they give it to me, I've got it. There are some statutory limitations. For example, psychologist records or rape counseling records or things like that have statutory privacy protections which may apply, and when subpoenaing that or requesting that type of information, the attorney has to be really careful not to step on any toes because you'll get sued for that. But basically, it's free for all, and that's the other thing, that's the difference between the subpoena and the search warrant, which is that the subpoena doesn't have to narrowly describe the things to be seized. I'm going to move on just a little bit and then go for questions, unless somebody has something exactly right on this.
Well, yeah, I would ask about nested attorneys and whether it's possible for a suing to protect itself by having an attorney first with an attorney-client privilege, followed by another attorney consulting on a case that then gets subpoenaed by you, for example.
I think that you could have as many levels or layers of attorneys as you want to hide your real identity. Did you?
Yeah. Is Yahoo required to tell Bozo that the records have been subpoenaed? Because if not, and they're not obligated to tell them, you've gotten it because this individual has not even had a chance or has not even been able to exercise their right to quash your subpoena.
Okay. So the first question was whether you could use several levels of attorneys to mask your true identity as Bozo, and I said yes. And then the second question is, does Yahoo have to tell Bozo that that they're being subpoenaed? And I think that that's governed by the terms of service in some ways, depending upon what the information is that's requested. And I'll get to this in a little bit. If I subpoena Bozo's email or something like that, it's governed by federal statute. But if I'm just asking for his account information or something like that, then it may not be governed by the federal statute. It may be governed by the terms of service. And you can see this. This happens. This is like a trend, this subpoenaing of people's pseudonyms to find out who it is really behind it. And in the Paragain Bloomberg case, which is a case recently where somebody put up false information about a company which was going public or which was publicly traded and cast the information in such a way that it looked like it was coming from Bloomberg, which is a very reputable company for getting information about public about companies that are traded publicly, they found that person mostly through, they found out who it was mostly through the cooperation of the major ISPs through which he published that information. So corporate cooperation with law enforcement is a fundamental reality, and it happens a lot. And you don't necessarily count on the fact that your corporate ISP is going to turn around and let you know when the subpoena is served without there being any kind of other federal requirement or law on the subject. The second level of court order that's required for an interception is a wiretap order, which is required for the interception of oral or wire communications, for example, your telephone calls. Does anybody know what the difference is between a wiretap order and a search warrant?
Wiretaps under Title III requires special consideration by the... It's under a special...
It's more than a search warrant. You have to show, first of all, it's a predicate offense, which means that you cannot get a wiretap to investigate certain crimes. Only the most serious and heinous of crimes can you get a wiretap in. Terrorism, organized crime, and, of course, drug trafficking. You have to show that you've tried other methods of investigation and they failed, and that there's really no other way to get the kind of information that you, the law enforcement investigator, needs other than to have a wiretap. And finally, you're required to minimize. And what that means is that you can't listen to everything. You can only listen to the things that are relevant to your investigation. It's a protection. So if I'm a drug dealer and my mom calls and we're talking about her medical problems, they're not allowed to listen to that. And then if, 5 minutes later, my colleague calls and we're talking about where we're going to drop off the shipment, then they are allowed to listen to that. They're not allowed to listen to the whole thing. So the three extra things you need for a wiretap are predicate offense, no other way, and minimization. Do you have a question?
Yes. How do they tell what they can listen to and what they can't, without actually having to listen to what they can't listen to?
They get to tune in. They have like a 2-minute-on, 2-minute-off rule, so they tune in 2 minutes and they listen, and if it's about the drug deal, then they get to keep listening, and then once it stops being about the drug deal, it goes on for 2 minutes, not about the deal, they have to stop and not listen for 2 minutes, and then they can come back on and listen for 2 minutes, and if they're talking about my mom, then they have to stop. So that's how it works. Two on, two off.
Is that specifically 2 minutes? Is that?
I think that's how they do it. That's how they do it in the Northern District. They do a two on, two off. That's how they do it in the Northern District of California.
Has there ever been a Title III for a computer crime case, to your knowledge?
The question is, has there been Title III for a computer crime case? And I don't think that's a predicate offense. I don't think Section 1030, the basic computer hacking crime, is a predicate offense. We're talking more about drug trafficking or organized crime or something of that nature.
A wiretap is restricted. Is a subpoena open-ended? Anybody, if they follow the process, can get a subpoena to go fishing for anything?
The subpoena is issued by a court. It has to be in the context of some kind of investigation or something like that. A wiretap has to be in the context of a law enforcement investigation. But a subpoena is much more open-ended than...
It's much easier
it's much easier to subpoena. You can subpoena in a civil case, all sorts of things. So yes, so we're talking about, and we're talking about level of protection. We're talking subpoena, search warrant, wiretap order. And just for those people who are policy minded, I just really want to highlight that difference when we talk about something like key escrow, because oftentimes when we're talking about legislating encryption or legislating key escrow, they say in order to sort of hold our hand, don't worry, we won't be able to get your key without a court order. And when they say court order, usually what they're talking about is subpoena. They're not necessarily talking about a search warrant with all the protections that you have there too. And they're not talking about notice. They're not talking about giving you notice. So keep that in mind if you're at all policy-minded about encryption. What all these things about search and seizure have to do with is they have to do with your privacy rights. And you have privacy rights of basically, I like to think of you as having your privacy rights that are assured to you under the Fourth Amendment. That is the things in which you have a reasonable expectation of privacy based upon our social and societal norms. And I like to think that sometimes the United States Congress sees fit to give us some extra privacy rights and tell us that there are certain extra additional things that we can feel secure in, even though ordinarily we might not. So privacy rights are assured to us sometimes by the Fourth Amendment and sometimes by statute. So, you know, people will say, well, it's not in the Constitution. Doesn't matter. If we want it to be private, we can make it private by statute. Perfect example of that, I think, is cordless phones. You're not allowed to listen in on somebody's cordless phone conversations. But anybody who knows anything about the technology knows that you should have no expectation of privacy in the stuff you say on a cordless phone. Just technically, the way it works, anybody can listen to what you're saying. But because it's a phone, people in Congress think it should be like your normal landline phone, and I agree. And so they've legislated that, although ordinarily you might not expect privacy, you get to have it. It's very good of them. And when we think about, so when you're thinking about searching and seizing something, you've got to think both under the Fourth Amendment what your privacy rights are and also the rights that are assured to you by statute. Do you have a question?
What about jurisdiction? What if you're Yahoo's in California, you're trying to get the information, you're in Washington, and the person, the perpetrator may be in New York or something like that. Who has jurisdiction? How, if one state has laws covering privacy information that the other state doesn't have, can that perpetrator have privacy?
Okay, some of that I can answer. First, let me say, the question's about jurisdiction. And first, let me say that I know nothing about internet jurisdiction. It's something that's been widely written on. It's very contentious. But because of the nature of my work, I know where the jurisdiction is. It's where my guy did the crime, and that's it. You know, physically where he's at. That's where jurisdiction is in the criminal case. So I really don't know that much about it otherwise. And your question about what privacy rights apply for, if there are privacy rights that adhere to you under the Fourth Amendment or under federal statute anywhere within the territory of the United States, unless you're a foreign national, in which case you don't enjoy some of the rights that citizens have. Okay? Otherwise, it depends upon what state the action happened in, and then the law of that state will apply.
But where the guy or lady made the connection, the phone connection was in New York, where the actual crime was, where the information was put, was like in California. So where did it happen?
Well, in other cases where we've seen this, for example, in a pornography case, the amateur action case. These people maintained a pornographic bulletin board system in California, which is relatively liberal when it comes to what's considered obscene and pornographic. God bless California. And the materials were downloadable and downloaded in the state of Tennessee, which is quite a bit has quite a bit different standards than California does. And these people were able to be prosecuted in Tennessee for material that was located in, posted in, and from their business in California. Now, there were some specific reasons for this. That's not going to always be the case. There were some special reasons for this. They knew people were coming from Tennessee to the bulletin board system and some other things like that. So when you're talking about these types of jurisdictional issues, it's very, in the law, we like to say totality of the circumstances, which means there's really no clear answer. Basically, it depends. But yes, it is possible for you to get dragged into court and convicted in Tennessee for something that you would be perfectly legal in San Francisco, California. which is a broad amount of things when it comes to obscenity. So when you're talking, and then, okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit, and I'm just going to go through and run through a couple of things and tell you what kind of court orders or what kind of things you need to look for when you're going to do a searching and seizing of it. And this is just really, this is, as I said, these are technical, and there are a lot of exceptions, and I'm just going to mention two because these apply most often. One is the business exception. Your employer can intercept or monitor things that you do if it is for a reasonable business purpose. And a reasonable business purpose can be something as lame as they want to make sure that you're not surfing the web on company time. So when you're in your employer's place of business, particularly if you work for a private employer, you don't have much in the right of private. So heads up. The second is the service provider exception, which means that the ISP or the telephone company can monitor the content of your phone calls in order to make sure that they're not being defrauded. Okay, and this can actually end up being a rather big exception or a rather large hole in your privacy rights, which are otherwise assured. Okay, so I'm just going to run through a couple of things so you know what it's what covers it in terms of when it's going to, and if you're an investigator and you want to do some intercepting. Telephone calls are oral communications covered by the wiretap laws at 18 U.S.C. section 2511 et sec. That's Latin for, and the ones that are right near it in the book. Email in transit is also a also covered by the wiretap law. It's a written communicate or an electronic communication, which is in transit, covered by the same statute. Once email becomes stored, it is no longer protected by the wiretap statutes. It becomes protected under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which is at 18 U.S.C. section 2702, and that chapter. Okay. Under that, there's a question in the back?
Yeah, there's an exception to that, and that is email on intermediate servers is still considered to be on the wire.
Okay, he's saying email on an intermediate server is still considered to be on the wire and would be covered by the wiretap statute?
Yes.
Thank you.
Like a pop server.
Okay. Once it's finally stored, which is when it reaches its terminal point, it becomes covered by ECPA, and that law says that the systems operator cannot disclose the content of that communication to third parties. If the communication is stored on that server for less than 180 days, the government needs a warrant. If the communication is stored on the server for more than 180 days, they need a subpoena with notice to the person whose email it is. Okay? What about your bills, your phone bills, or the phone numbers you call, or the phone numbers of the people who have called you? Those are all things that investigator can get with a subpoena. You're not considered to have a right of privacy in that information because you've voluntarily, if necessarily, already disclosed it to the telephone company. That brings up, I think, question?
You had mentioned that the mail either needs a subpoena or a warrant. What about logs of transit for the mail, such that I can show that such and so person received mail from another person?
Right. The transit logs are not the content of the communication. So I can get those either by having the ISP voluntarily turn them over to me, or I can subpoena them, and there's no need for notice.
Okay.
A pager provides a sort of hybrid circumstance. A numeric pager only tells you the numbers of the people who have called you. So for a numeric pager, under the law, technically you only really need a court order or a subpoena. But an alphanumeric pager may have the content or the substance of messages in it. And because you're intercepting the content of the messages, it's regulated by probably the same rules as email in terms of it being an electronic communication. So get those alphanumeric pagers. It's much safer.
The
question is whether real-time monitoring of pagers is against the law. And real-time monitoring of an alphanumeric pager is going to be covered by the wiretap laws. Real-time monitoring of a pager that just beeps but doesn't give any number or anything like that, you just want to know when somebody's being paged, probably you can do that without any kind of court order whatsoever. For a numeric pager where you're going to capture the number, you need to follow the same procedure you would for a pen register or a trap and trace and get a court order, but not a warrant. Okay. So you're an investigator. How are you going to investigate these types of crimes when you have all this different type of electronic evidence and there's all these statutes that apply? First of all, follow the law. There are civil and criminal penalties which adhere should you fail to follow the complex maze of federal statutes. Second of all, your company or your organization should establish formal procedures for the preservation of evidence. When you make it routine, it happens the right way each time, and you can check and make sure that the procedures are correct and you don't have any variance between one investigation and the other, and there's no way for the defense attorney to come in point and say, well, they took this extra precaution to make sure that everything happened right in case A, and in my case B, they didn't do that, so my evidence isn't trustworthy. The evidence in my case is tainted and my client goes free. So formal procedures are essential. When you do the investigation, you should have backups, both regular backups of the system files generally, and also once you seize the potential evidence, you want to make bitstream backups of that. Not just the files, but the erased file space and the swap file and all of that stuff. Because there's valuable information in there, and the loss of that information is something that a defense attorney can use to show that the evidence collection procedures were not properly done, and that the evidence therefore can't be authenticated and cannot be relied upon. In the back.
I was going to comment on the situation analyzing something like this, which may obtain an attachment and yet it may be covered under the privacy concerns.
Melissa, for example, Melissa comes as an attachment to email, right? So once I receive it as email in my box, it's mine. I can give it to anybody I want. Although that might be rude, but...
the problems of analyzing that kind of virus or whatever from the legal context, when you say that the mail is protected and you need a warrant to... they examine it or forward it, and yet how can you
Once the email's mine, once David Smith sends me the Melissa virus, if he is the perpetrator in fact, and once I've got it, I can give it to law enforcement if I want. He sent it to me, so we don't need to have any kind of like warrant for that sort of thing.
Can you go through the system logs, your server, to discover who has received this and something like that, when you have not yourself received it as a sysadmin, but you know that other employees have received it?
Right. Okay, the question is whether the systems operator can look through the logs to determine who's gotten the infecting email, and the answer is yes. First of all, it's a business exception. Second of all, it's the service provider exception, because I'm the systems operator. I'm the provider of the service to the company, for example. And third of all, I'm not intercepting the content of the communication. Okay, I'm just looking at where it went. So that can be quite a bit different. These laws in terms of intercepting email, we're talking about intercepting and capturing the content of email. This is just seeing where it went. So there's numerous reasons why the laws that I've been talking about would not apply to that specific circumstance. Does that answer your question?
I guess I would assume that an attachment might be deemed to be content, or I don't know, that you may be wanting to analyze the content for some malicious program, and you're not just interested initially in traffic. I think maybe in all
He's pointing out that if the attachment is, that you might want to look at the attachment for content in order to determine exactly what its nature is. And again, I would say those first two exceptions apply. It also gets into I'll mention it just because I think it's interesting, the question of whether a program, for example, some kind of executable file, can be considered a communicative or a content-related communication. And in the Ninth Circuit, we've faced exactly that problem in the Bernstein case. Is an encryption algorithm communicative and thus protected by the First Amendment, or is it just a program or a routine or marching orders and not protected by the First Amendment? And in the Ninth Circuit, so far, they've held that that is a communication. So what you're talking about is definitely an on-the-edge legal issue, whether an executable file is considered a communication and interception thereof would otherwise be governed by the ECPA or by the wiretap rules.
Okay. Comment about programs, filtering programs that are examining content.
All these, he's asking about filtering programs. All these come under the business use exception or the service provider exception. If I was law enforcement and I wanted to install like a sniffer program or something like that on somebody else's corporate network, no, I can't do that. Okay, I'm back to, do you want to ask yours now?
Regarding the evidence collection.
Uh-huh.
You can invalidate evidence collected by one agent, say at a specific time. Does it further invalidate anything else collected within possibly that day or other computers in the same room? Can you make it a more sweeping argument saying that none of the evidence collected is valid?
The question is, once I shoot down one piece of evidence, how many other dominoes fall? And it depends on why that evidence is bad and how what the relationship of the subsequent pieces of evidence is. In Fourth Amendment jurisdiction, if I get something kicked out of court because it was obtained in violation of the Fourth Amendment, anything that's the fruits of that discovery also gets excluded from court. If I'm getting it kicked out of court because it's not reliable or because they couldn't authenticate it, I as the judge, the person who's going to let the evidence in or out, am going to look at each piece of evidence and see whether the proponent of that evidence is going to be able to authenticate it. You want to, when you're doing a computer crime investigation, not use or allow any access by anyone to the evidence. Don't let anybody use or be near the computer that's going to be the evidence against the perpetrator. That seems sort of self-evident, but you might want to lock it up. Keep audit logs and keep backups. And finally, you want to designate a single person to be the evidence custodian. This makes it easier for the easier for law enforcement if they come into the case, easier for you to know who to send to court in order to say, this is where we got it, this is where it's from.
Just real quick on the evidence, if it gets thrown out, if there's another way that you can get to that evidence, another path that you can prove, can you reintroduce that evidence back into the court showing a different way that you procured the another trusted way that you procured that evidence?
The question is, if I get something kicked out, can it come in another way? And if I have a piece of evidence that can't be authenticated one way but can be authenticated another way, then it may come in. If I have a piece of evidence that's excluded because of Fourth Amendment considerations, it does not come in. If I have a piece of evidence that's excluded because of Fifth Amendment considerations, I got somebody to incriminate themselves, it can come in if they testify, for example, to impeach them. It all depends on why it stays out. Okay. So, in light of all these specific considerations that seem to come up more, especially in computer crime cases, encryption, anonymity, these sorts of things, we can see in recent prosecutions or investigations how law enforcement has been dealing with these issues. And what we've seen, I think, by law enforcement is a somewhat creative mixture of the use of computer forensics and good old-fashioned old-school techniques. So, for example, what we see that they can do is an ISP gets its password file stolen. They look at the ISP audit logs. They find out that the attacker came from Intel, right? They go over to Intel and they kind of ask around. Somebody says, "Yeah, I don't really like the looks of so-and-so. He seems like, kind of a shady character." They go over to so-and-so, and they start interviewing him, first sort of friendly-like, and then they kind of drop some hints that they think it's him. And soon enough, that guy at Intel confesses. Well, they could never prove it was him from the audit logs that they have. And they would never have been able to get him to confess if they hadn't had the audit logs to wave in front of him and say, you know, here's how come we think we've been turned on to you and think that it's you. But they use these things in combination in order to get the person and put them on trial. Another perfect example of this, which is basically an end run, is the Salgado case, where the defendant stole a bunch of credit card numbers from an ISP. And he was bragging online about having the credit card numbers and wanting to sell them. So what somebody who was online at the time of the bragging reported him to the FBI. And what the FBI did is they took this person and used that person as a cooperating witness. It's an FBI term. We say snitch in my business. And got that person to agree to buy the credit card numbers from Mr. Salgado. And Salgado was going to encrypt them. Now, the problem for law enforcement, as you know, because you can hear them crying about it in the newspaper all the time, is encryption prevents them from figuring out what exactly the thing is. They're in trouble. They can't break the encryption, so it's troublesome for them. But obviously, if you're selling the credit card numbers to somebody, they've got it. So they had a plan, and their plan was this. They got Mr. Salgado to come and meet the cooperating witness in the smoking lounge at the San Francisco airport. Does anybody want to guess why they picked the smoking lounge? Pete, do you want to guess?
He
goes through the gun check. So when he goes through security, they know he's unarmed. There's no need for them to frisk him or be worried about him at all. So he meets the guy in the smoking lounge. They meet up. He gives him the money. He gives him the encrypted credit card numbers on the CD. And he's encrypted them, so if he's arrested on the way over, nobody knows that they're credit card numbers. He can't get convicted. But the buyer needs to know what the password is so he can decrypt and use them. So he also gives him a copy of I think it was Mario Puzo's Last Don, with a couple of words on the last page underlined, and that was the password. So cooperating witness just gives the CD and the book over to the FBI. They decrypt it. It's thousands of credit card numbers, and Mr. Salgado gets convicted.
What about compulsory private key production? If law enforcement sees this encrypted evidence, and it's obviously encrypted for some reason, how can an individual be compelled to produce private keys?
The question is there a method for compulsory production of private keys? Is there a way that they can force you to turn the key over? And that is not been tested, but my opinion is that it's a violation of the Fifth Amendment. Say again? What is that?
Rubber hose
gun. Oh, to beat him, beat it out of him? Before they get the hose, call an attorney. That would be my advice. I think that would be covered by the Fifth Amendment. There's a lot of, one of the things is that we are just only now really beginning to see more and more of these kinds of investigations and prosecutions. So there's a lot of things that are unanswered, a lot of questions we don't know. There's just not a lot of case law on these things. I just want to briefly say why, and then I'm going to open it up to questions. One of the main reasons why we're not seeing these cases go to trial is exactly what you see in the Mitnick case with damages. And what that is that the companies come in with such an inflated estimation of damages, and the defendant is not entitled to any kind of extensive discovery or information on how they came up with that estimation of damages. The damages number increases multifold the amount of time that the person would do in federal prison should they be convicted. So you have this huge sword hanging over your head in terms of the damages. And you may think the damages estimate is bullshit, but then they come to you and they're kind of offering you some sort of deal. And you're looking at the possibility of having this huge amount of prison time based on this inflated damages estimate, or taking the deal, or hoping that you're going to be able to fight every little hourly, you know, every hour the employee put in, every piece of software that they purchased, every, you know, credit card number that they found, and whittle the damages number down in front of a jury so that you could, you know, maybe hope that your client's not going to go away for so many years. And what that basically does is it scares defendants and it scares defense attorneys into taking deals. And so most of these cases end in a plea bargain. Most of all cases end in a plea bargain, but most of these cases seem to be ending in plea bargains. I'll take questions now on anything or everything related to my topic.
Speaking of Mitnick, comment or
your insight as to what appears to be the first Title III search or implementation for his activities in Raleigh, North Carolina, where Shimomura and others intercepted cellular and data communications?
I don't know that much about it, but I know it's an issue because it has to. He's asking me whether about the phone interceptions of Mitnick in Raleigh, North Carolina, and it's an interesting issue because we're talking about somebody who's a hybrid government agent, private industry agent, an issue which is very interesting but untested because the case ended in plea.
If it was deemed Title III, is there any grounds for dismissing the evidence because of that? Mm-hmm. Title III was obtained for fraudulent reasons, or however you want to put it?
If they were acting as government agents, and if Title III applied and they did not comply with the Title III requirements, the evidence would be excluded from court, yes. Dave?
Two questions. First of all, do you have any observations or comments that you'd like to share with us on the use of digital signatures on the so-called Toto case, where a secret key that made a signature was actually compromised and the passphrase suit was known to the public, and yet he was still essentially convicted on the basis of digital signature that was made with that key?
I'm sorry.
Second part of the thing is, do you have any links or information up on your website at granted.com?
The first question was, he asked me if I had any comments about the Toto case and the fact that digital signature was used to convict him. I don't know enough about the connection about the purity of his connection with that digital signature to comment on whether that really was a valid way to convict him. What I do have a feeling about in that case is a very old school one, which is that the criminal justice system is not for people who are mentally ill. We need to deal with our mentally ill people a little bit better than that. And the second question he asked me was about my website at granik.com, because Dave gave me granik.com for my 30th birthday last week, so no information on there yet. Over there? Yes, you, then you're next.
Just regarding the fact that the cost of the process of ascertaining damages plays back into the damages, does that not seem circular? How is that recommended?
Figuring out how much damage was done creates additional damage itself. Doesn't that seem dumb, is the question, and the answer is yes. And in some cases, when basically you're leaving the amount of damages in the hands of the victims themselves, you're allowing a situation that can be rife for abuse. For example, if you let Sun figure out what the value is of the fact that Mitnick looked at their proprietary information and they charge him with the entire R&D value of $80 million, you're really looking at something that's rife for abuse. It just should be said, though, that in terms of what the estimate is, it does have to be proven and reasonable.
You said that the email in transit was covered by the wiretap.
That's correct.
So if I use my sniffer and I see some email going by, I'm technically breaking the law.
Email in transit is covered by the wiretap laws, meaning that you cannot intercept the content of the email communication, meaning like what the email says.
Unencrypted packets, I'm seeing the email.
Yes, that is. But if you're the systems operator and it's on your system, that's the exception. See what I'm saying? There's the system exception. The system can monitor its own email, and a business can monitor things that are on the business premises for a reasonable business purpose. Those are two very broad exceptions.
So if it's encrypted, then they can't read it, and they don't even have the opportunity to
step. Obviously, if it was encrypted, that would create a different sort of circumstance. Adam?
Is this subject to both the wiretap statute and the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, or I wasn't aware that there was a complete exception for the wiretap?
There is a business exception for the wiretap. Yes, there is.
Was it legal for a company to be able to look at your email when they can't look at it? So I was told that until you actually downloaded it and read it, it's covered under the Privacy Act, but it's the device system that you can actually access.
The question is about when can your employer read your email? Is that correct? I would say that if your email comes to your place of business and if your workstation is owned by your employer, beware.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to look over at this side of the room now. Yes? Jay?
Just a question, and I've never had a satisfactory answer to this. Say in the case of Mitnick, Sun posts $80 million in damages, but they do not make such a disclosure to their stockholders as they are publicly traded. Would that be knocked out of court based on the fact that they're not claim any such loss where they're obliged to?
So the question is, if Sun claims an $80 million loss based on Mitnick's activities, but they never disclose that loss to their stockholders or to the IRS or anything like that, does that mean that that evidence is out of court? And the answer is no, it's not kicked out of court, but it is fertile grounds for cross-examination by the defense attorney. Okay. Yes? Yes, you.
Can you
Oh, sorry.
Can you monitor the emails traffic?
The question is, can you monitor where the email is going without looking at it? Who are you in this?
If I'm on a server and I have the ability to see traffic going by, it does not belong to me.
Are you the system operator?
No.
You're law enforcement?
No. A private
party of some sort. I would say, and you want to do traffic analysis of some other party's system?
No, if there is traffic on my network.
If it's your network, yes, you can do that. Okay. Yes?
We have a lot of training for defense attorneys. We have a lot of training for prosecution and law enforcement. We're getting more regarding cybercrime and evidence and everything. What are we doing for the judges? Because that's where a lot of the problems from the defense side is, from law enforcement side is, from the corporation side is. But what are we doing to help the judges?
The question is, what kind of training are judges getting and keeping up to speed on these types of issues? And the answer is probably very little. Some judges need a lot of work. I mean, this is not the only field in which judges can be deficient. I can make a list.
There are three good judges. They're all on
the
Ninth Circuit, right?
As a officer of the court and a member of the California Bar, I'm not allowed to name names, but.
Exception that businesses have and the providers. So providers sit on the network and he can find mail traffic, no big deal. He can pretty much gather enough evidence that if that was what the law enforcement had at that point, it would be something he doesn't even have a warrant at this point, would have enough to even bring for a grand jury. At what point can that system administrator hand whatever information he's got over to the law enforcement?
When can the system administrator who's done an investigation hand that information over to law enforcement? And the question is, the answer is he can go to law enforcement if, let's say, he's figured out it's enough to bring the case to a grand jury, which is not necessarily all that much. But he can go to law enforcement and say, here's the kind of thing I found, and then they need to go through the proper procedures before they can actually get the substance of the information from the systems operator. The systems operator is prohibited from disclosing to third parties, even to law enforcement, the content of these communications under ECPA. In order for law enforcement, it's a source, but in order for law enforcement to have enough information to present to the judge to get the warrant, it has to have some kind of substance. And that substance, the system administrator is prohibited from giving to law enforcement. He can say, you guys should start looking into this, and they start at the very beginning with a source. But the source, if he's the systems operator, and if he's seen things that he can see only because he's the sysop, he's not allowed to then go and tell that to law enforcement. That's what I would argue.
You're saying he can't give specifics, but he can say in general, I have seen in this system evidence of child pornography.
He's saying
that's not content necessarily, specific content. He's a source of information. Law enforcement could go to the judge, I have a credible source, credible information. the judge issues a warrant.
Basically, what we're talking about here is whether the system administrator exception is sort of an end run, because the systems administrator can do this investigation, find out the basic gist of the thing, and then go to law enforcement and maybe not hand over copies of the email, but say, I've seen child porn, or I see terrorist threats, or I see drug trafficking, or something like that. And from there, law enforcement gets to go forward. And I would challenge that, but I think that that's probably a whole, that probably is a weakness there in terms of people's privacy. Yeah, I think from there, if law enforcement was careful and took the proper steps to adhere to their requirements under the statutory law, that that would be okay. Although I'd file a big motion on something like that. Way in the back?
Yeah, we run into this fairly frequently in the investigations that we do. It really turns on whether the organization has a policy, a formal, acknowledged policy that says that individuals that work for that organization and are using the organization's systems have no expectation of privacy. If that's an acknowledged policy within the organization, then under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, it constitutes prior consent. At that point, the system administrator and the company security people can monitor the content, not just source and destination, and they can build enough of a case to go to law enforcement. It all hinges on the policy.
Did everybody hear that? That's an excellent answer. Thank you. Okay. In the blue shirt right here?
Yes. Talking on the same subject, there's a bunch of folks popping up that have subscription services. Out of California, there's the one company that provides the internet law guides. They're like free binders. They update them every 3 months. Do you have any other content that's good to review that you see as references for as this is progressing?
I just keep up with what's in the paper, on mailing lists and that sort of thing. I mean, if you're, it's sort of your field, you just kind of keep up with it. But I can't think of anything where I would say this is definitely the greatest resource you've got to go to. Is my time up? My time is up. I'll take more questions later on. Thank you.